Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Reporting by major news organizations continues to shed light on the firing of James Comey. The New York Times cites four congressional sources who say Comey had asked for more agents and other resources to accelerate the Russia interference investigation just days before he was fired. Who did his request for money and other resources go to? Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, who then wrote the letter justifying the president's desire to fire Comey. The Times and the Post described Trump as building toward this decision over the last few weeks because of growing anger over Comey's public statements about the Russia investigation, focusing on Russia more than on leaks and contradicting Trump's claim that Obama wiretapped Trump Tower. The Times says Comey's fate was sealed by his latest testimony to Congress. Mr. Trump burned as he watched, convinced that Comey was grandstanding, says the Times. He was particularly irked when Mr. Comey said he was mildly nauseous to think that his handling of the email case had influenced the election, which Mr. Trump took to demean his own role in history. At that point, says the Times, Mr. Trump began talking about firing him. The Post says that Monday morning in Washington, Trump told Vice President Pence and several senior aides, Reince Priebus, Steve Bannon, and Donald McGahn, the White House counsel, among others, that he was ready to move on Comey. First, though, he wanted to talk with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, his trusted confidant, and Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein, to whom Comey reported directly. Trump summoned the two of them to the White House for a meeting, according to a person close to the White House. The president already had decided to fire Comey, according to this person, but in the meeting, several White House officials said Trump gave Sessions and Rosenstein a directive to explain in writing the case against Comey, says the Washington Post. It also reports that Rosenstein himself, who has a long reputation for independence, threatened to resign after the narrative emerging from the White House on Tuesday cast him as a prime mover of the decision to fire Comey and that the president acted only on his recommendation, said the person close to the White House, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of that matter. So the Washington Post only has one source for that, but interesting if true that Rosenstein threatened to resign because Trump was hanging this Comey firing decision wrongly on him. Trump tweeted yesterday that Comey had lost the confidence of almost everyone in Washington, not just him. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday said morale at the FBI was low.
And most importantly, the rank and file of the FBI had lost confidence in their director.
But in the Washington Post today, Thomas O'Connor, the president of the FBI Agents Association, called Comey's firing a gut punch. We didn't see it coming, and we don't think Director Comey did anything that would lead to this, unquote. The Post says many employees said they were furious about the firing, saying the circumstances of his dismissal did more damage to the FBI's independence than anything Comey did in his three-plus years in the job. Meanwhile, the House Oversight Committee chairman, Republican Jason Chaffetz of Utah, called for the Justice Department's Inspector General to investigate the firing. And the Senate Intelligence Committee has now subpoenaed documents from Michael Flynn regarding his contacts with Russia. NBC News reports the committee initially requested the documents from Flynn in a letter on April 28th, but he declined to comply if he wasn't offered immunity. The Intelligence Committee declined the deal and has now followed up with an official subpoena. And if Trump has been trying to sidestep the Russia investigation by firing Comey, Sally Yates, and maybe Preet Bharara's firing was related to this too, an analysis in USA Today says Trump's decision to fire Comey means the campaign won't end. With me is the author of that analysis, USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, great to be with you.
And also with us, New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos. His article yesterday was called How Comey's Firing Accelerates the Russia Investigations. His in-depth article last week was called How Trump Could Get Fired. Hi, Evan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be here.
So, Evan, how does firing Comey accelerate rather than stall the Russia investigations?
Well, I think there are procedural reasons, and then there are what we might call cultural reasons. The procedural reasons, which you elegantly described in the preamble there, are that the way in which he fired Comey, which were, we could now reasonably say, it was an impulsive decision in the sense that it did not take into account what the full political implications would be. He hadn't sounded this out with members of his own party in any broad sense, and certainly not with Democrats or inside the law enforcement community. And therefore, it's already generated significant antibodies. You've already got Jason Chaffetz, a Republican, calling for an inspector general's investigation of the firing. And then on top of that, and I should say there's one other piece of this, which is very important, which is that Jeff Sessions, who had formerly recused himself from the Russia investigation, is now clearly, by the White House's own narrative, involved in deciding whether or not the person leading the Russia investigation should stay in the job. So that is the definition of recusal that I think the political that was understood at the time by the public. And then the cultural reason is simple, which is that the FBI was, as you described, this was a gut punch for agents who have been dedicating themselves to being independent and serious in their pursuit of the facts in the Russia investigation. And all of a sudden, their boss has been fired while in Los Angeles speaking to a room full of FBI agents. And they the reporting is very clear on this. The mood in the FBI is demoralized, and they are not backing away, but in fact are redoubling their commitment to making sure this investigation is credible and thorough.
Susan, I gather there's a technical problem and you weren't able to hear Evan's answer, but you wrote independently that the firing of Comey means the campaign won't end, meaning the 2016 election campaign?
It just keeps going on. You know, even after the 2000 election, which was a disputed election, had to be settled by the Supreme Court, took 35 days to figure out who won, people moved on. And there was a sense that the election had ended in an unhappy way for a lot of Democrats, but that it was over. But in this election, it is not over because of the investigations into the Russia ties, because President Trump keeps going back to it. We saw an evidence of that even today with his expected signing of an executive order that will set up a commission studying election fraud. You know, he's argued that he would have won the popular vote if only 3 million illegal ballots hadn't been cast. And also with the reemergence of Hillary Clinton arguing that she was robbed of the election, in effect, in the final days by Russia and by the intervention of the now former FBI director, James Comey. So there's a sense that this the arguments over the election are just continue to shape what we see happening. And that, I think, has an effect on the ability to get other things done. I think it's really a complicating factor as the government tries to move forward.
Susan, based on all the reporting today, those details I went over from the Washington Post and New York Times stories, plus things you have in USA Today and elsewhere, the White House was just lying if it said the firing only had to do with how Comey handled the Clinton investigation and nothing to do with Russia. They said, Pence went out to the cameras and said nothing to do with Russia. Susan, has this been proven to your satisfaction to call it a lie and say it seems to have everything to do with Russia?
I think we've talked before about how powerful the word lie is. I think that it is clear that the White House's initial explanation tying this not to the Russia investigation, but rather to Comey's actions on Hillary Clinton's emails, did not pass the common sense-o-meter test. It wasn't credible. It's not credible. It is pretty clear, I think, based on reporting that this decision was made because of President Trump's concern about the Russia investigation, not because he was suddenly seized with concern about Comey's actions on Hillary Clinton's emails, which he had previously praised. So I think whether you called it a lie or a misrepresentation or something else, it clearly wasn't true.
Evan, you want to go there at all?
Yeah, I think Susan's absolutely right. And I'll add one coda to the observation that this extends the campaign. Because actually, I'll invert that point in a way that I think is meaningful, which is, yes, it extends the politics of the campaign and some of the tactics of the campaign, but in an important way. If Trump operates now as he did during the campaign, he will find himself under extraordinary legal and political vulnerability, because he can't get up in front of Congress or in front of other parts of the government and make statements that are patently untrue. And if he does so, he's exposing himself to very serious consequences, which he wasn't as a candidate. He basically discovered, he sort of was trained to believe that you could say anything in politics and there would be no consequences. In fact, you might even win the White House. But that's not the case now. And if he continues down this path, we know what the consequences are. History is eloquent on that subject.
Listeners, our phones are open, 212-433-WNYC. Anything on the Trump administration post-firing of Comey, even pre-firing of Comey leading up to it, 212-433-9692. For Evan Osnos from The New Yorker and Susan Page from USA Today. Evan, your article last week was partly about how Trump is increasingly insulated from anyone who can check his impulses. What's some of your evidence for that?
Well, I talked to people in his orbit, friends, advisors, people who are in touch with him, and a couple of important data points floated to the surface. Number one, one of his friends described to me, Chris Ruddy, who is CEO of Newsmax, described to me the fact that it's quite clear that Trump is not receiving bad news. As Chris Ruddy put it to me, he said that some of Trump's White House aides now come to him to ask him to deliver bad news because they don't want to do it themselves. Another one of Trump's advisors has described his environment as, quote, Fortress Trump is how he put it to me. So why does that matter? Because if you look back at the history of presidencies, when they become secluded and insulated and cut off from bad news, it makes it hard for them to make smart, safe decisions, and they end up doing reckless things.
And your article from last week makes the case that there is a fairly high likelihood that Trump won't complete his term. And this includes both the possibility of impeachment and of removal via the 25th Amendment, which would require a majority of the cabinet, and I think two-thirds of Congress, correct me if I'm wrong, to decide that he's lost the mental capacity to be president of the United States. So what kind of likelihood do you see? Why are you writing this article now?
I'll say one thing, just to edit a bit of how you described
sure.
it. I wouldn't say that we'd say that there's a high likelihood at all. In fact, I mean, you have to say at the outset that the evidence is very clear that most presidents, in fact, the vast majority of presidents, complete their term, 34 out of 45 so far. So, you know, two presidents have been impeached. Neither one was ultimately removed from office. Only one has left through resignation. But Donald Trump is not a normal president in the historical sense. The simple fact is, we've never had a president assume office who is as old as Donald Trump is today. We have never had a president assume office who has retained ownership over a business empire. Remember, he's given up day-to-day control, but he has not given up ownership. And then, of course, the third one is he has no experience in politics or in public office, and therefore he doesn't have some of the calluses that you might have learning how to make decisions that don't cause you negative consequences. For that reason, and this is what inspired this article a couple of months ago when I started down this track, was a very simple question, which is, why is it that this president is already at the very beginning of his presidency at a lower point in popularity than any newly elected president in the history of polling? That exposes him to an extraordinary level of risk, because unpopular presidents are presidents in peril. That's what the law and history says.
Susan, it's funny that Trump would have been enraged by Comey testifying last week that he was mildly nauseated by the thought that he could have affected the election, because Democrats were enraged by that. They took the word mildly to mean he wasn't troubled enough by the fact that his October 28th letter may have flipped the election. Can you understand or explain, if the Times reporting on this is right, that was like the last straw for Trump with Comey, why that might have been the last straw for Trump?
Well, because President Trump, we know, has a pretty thin skin. He takes insults personally. He also expects loyalty from the people who work for him. And the fact is, the FBI director works for the President of the United States. And I think that was, if there's one thing that caused President Trump to want to fire James Comey, is the feeling that he wouldn't be loyal to Donald Trump. He might well be loyal to the institution of the presidency, but not to Trump personally. And that is something that we know that Donald Trump prizes a great deal. You know, and just to talk about Evan's article, which I thought was so interesting, and reminded us that there was one discussion that we know about to use the 25th Amendment to consider removing a president in the final year and a half, I guess, of President Reagan's term. But really an interesting article makes the point that it's remote, the possibility of forcibly removing him. But what is more likely is that President Trump will lose his political clout, his ability to do very much. He'll be undercut in the way that, say, Jimmy Carter was during his term when he became unpopular, lost the support of many in his own party, and just wasn't the factor in governing that presidents usually are. That seems to me to be a much more likely prospect than actually removing him from office.
Susan, do you know anything about Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, and about this Post report that he was threatening to resign on Tuesday night because Trump was inaccurately hanging the Comey firing on him?
I know that he is highly respected. I haven't covered him or interviewed him myself, but I know that some Democratic senators involved in this confirmation process went to him and talked privately about that they were really hanging their hopes on him to be a voice that stood up for kind of the constitutional protections, kind of a very traditional protector of the American system of government when he took over this job. And in that way, the Post report wasn't surprising. It's that Rob Rosenstein wanted to protect his own reputation right out of the box with these White House stories. But we should also note that there is some serious reporting this morning, pushback against the idea that he did threaten to resign. Pete Williams, for instance, has a couple sources saying
NBC.
That didn't happen.
Okay. Kevin in Monroe, you're on WNYC with Evan Osnos from The New Yorker and Susan Page from USA Today. Hello, Kevin.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning to you again.
Good morning.
Good morning. The question I want to ask you, with all the executive order that Donald Trump passed and the law that he has passed, if he gets impeached and removed from office, what would happen to those laws? And also, if he were supposed to be removed, who would take over? Would the vice president take over? I'll take my answer off here.
Kevin, thank you very much. Evan, I think all laws certainly and all executive orders remain in effect unless next president were to reverse the executive orders, as Trump has done in some of the cases of Obama executive orders, right?
Yep, that's absolutely right. They would remain in effect. The vice president would take over in any of the scenarios that are plausible. If I can, I'll go back to something which Susan mentioned. Mm-hmm. I thought she's absolutely right that the scenario which we mapped out in the story that seems most plausible to me is the Jimmy Carter scenario. It's essentially the possibility that a president becomes isolated from not only from the opposition party, but also from members of his own party. And you remember Jimmy Carter, it may seem like a strange comparison to compare Carter and Trump. They're sort of stylistic and moral opposites in every way. But they both came into Washington as outsiders, declaring to their intention to shake things up. They challenged members of their own party. And as a result, they ended up, in some sense, besieged. And that, I think, is the framework that's most useful for understanding Trump, which is that he is a president. He has a presidency under siege. And that scenario produces its own dynamics. And that's how you end up with a president that makes choices that, in fact, don't make him safer, but put him at greater risk over time.
But Jimmy Carter lost an election to Ronald Reagan. Nobody really talked in the late 70s, I don't think, about impeaching him or
right.
that he might resign because he was losing his popular support.
Not remotely. I mean, Jimmy Carter, you know, at the end of the day, an impeachment is only possible if somebody is doing things that are considered an abuse of office, a violation of the public trust, and nobody, even his fiercest opponents, ever said anything like that about Jimmy Carter. My point about Carter is that It is very, very hard for any presidency to be to end before its appointed hour. It's just not an easy process. And so what's more likely is that they end up isolated. But, you know, Trump, for all the reasons we've talked about, is not a perfect parallel to historical precedent.
We'll continue in a minute with Evan Osnos from The New Yorker and Susan Page from USA Today. And your call. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Evan Osnos from The New Yorker and Susan Page, USA Today's Washington Bureau Chief, and Francesca in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello. Francesca, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi there. What's your question?
My question is, what do these professionals think about barring U.S. photographers and journalists from Trump's meeting with Russian diplomats the day after he fired Comey and said, this has nothing to do with Russia?
Yeah, Susan, that was pretty weird optics yesterday. Maybe some of it was a coincidence that on the day that everybody's comparing what Trump did with Comey to the Saturday night massacre when Nixon fired the Watergate prosecutor, there he is meeting not only with the top Russians, but also with Henry Kissinger. And then he bars U.S. photographers because I guess they were aware of the optics, but he lets the Russian photographers in. What was up with that?
You know, I've seen some weird things in the decades I've covered Washington, but yesterday's that was definitely on the list. And the question, one question, is whether it was like some kind of deliberate in your face, I'll do what I want, sort of strategy, or something more coincidental. And the White House says it was coincidental. I guess we'll never know. On the photos, the White House did push back this morning on what happened with the photos. They say that they were told this was Lavrov's personal photographer, his official photographer, and not a news photographer. But they let those photo crews in, and it turns out this photographer also works for TASS, and so they were everywhere. And the idea of course, we take real, as White House correspondents, the Washington Press Corps takes very seriously access to the president for big events like this. And under the kind of traditional coverage rules in the White House, there would have been the White House press pool allowed to go and at least shoot some pictures at the beginning of that meeting. The White House this morning used the words, they tricked us, they lied to us about who the photographer was, but that does not testify to their own skill and competence in handling situations like this.
David in North Bergen, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Hello?
Go ahead, David. You're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to make a comment and then ask one question. My comment is, I don't know what's wrong with journalists today. I can't distinguish between opinion and news. A lot of what's on the network news is just opinion, but yet they report it as news. They don't separate news and opinion. I think that's a real shame. And my question is, where is the evidence? I'm waiting for the evidence of collusion. Every day on this station and on all the network news, all I hear is there's a potential for this, and this may have happened. And you got the senator from Connecticut talking about possible impeachment. Yet, I'm waiting. If there's evidence, I want to see it. Where is there any evidence? I thought that's what journalism was supposed to be about any collusion.
David, that's
investigating this for months, and I haven't seen any evidence.
It's a really fair question, and I'm going to bring Evan and Susan in on this. But I want to say, regarding journalism, that journalists have a lot to report that's actually happening. So when the FBI director Comey says, for example, in a congressional hearing that there is a formal investigation going on into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, that's huge news. And that requires that journalists report it and then look at what it might be and label speculation and label evidence that would lead the FBI to open that formal investigation. But we didn't make this up. The FBI really is investigating this, plus all these other things that happened, Jeff Sessions being caught making a false statement in his confirmation hearing about his contacts with Russia during the campaign and then recusing himself from the investigation. Michael Flynn lying and then get fired. I mean, these things happen.
May I make a comment and then I'd like my question answered?
Please.
This is what has happened in November. The media was embarrassed by the outcome of the election. I just think the media is so out of touch. and they just talk to one another, the whole Washington media, the whole political establishment, Democrats and Republicans, were just so embarrassed. And I just think that they have it in their heart, people like Jeff Flake and these other people who never said a damn thing about Obama over 8 years, they just have it in their heart that, oh, my God, how could this guy be elected? Yeah.
But Jeff Flake is a conservative Republican senator from Arizona.
All that conservative.
Sorry?
I wouldn't say he's all that conservative. All he does, including John McCain, who's now become, again, the darling of the media, is attack other Republicans, especially Trump.
David, thank you very much. So, Susan and Evan, let me ask you the bottom line, and I guess this is speculation, but how much do either of you think, from what you've seen so far, that the Trump campaign did collude with Russia, or that anyone is guilty of illegally covering that up, or that that will ultimately be found? Evan?
Well, this...
Or Susan, go ahead. Go ahead, Susan.
This is, of course, this is the subject of five investigations, five committees on Capitol Hill looking at this, and the FBI. But we already know that there are five or six people close to the Trump campaign or part of the Trump campaign who had contact with Russia and Russian officials and Russian interests, and that is exactly what we're looking at. You know, Paul Manafort, who for a time was in effect Trump's campaign manager, Jared Kushner, now at the White House, Jeff Sessions, two meetings, which you mentioned, Carter Page is another one. It's not that there's no evidence of contact, and the question is, what were they talking about? And Michael Flynn, of course, it's already cost him his job at the White House because he not only had contacts with the Russians, but he misrepresented them to the vice president, who then misrepresented them to the American people. So we're not without evidence. We don't know where it goes. We don't know that there was collusion, but we know that there is enough evidence of contact that it's prompted these series of serious investigations into what exactly happened.
Evan?
You know, I think it's worth reminding ourselves that Richard Burr, who is a Republican senator from North Carolina, was part of the Trump campaign, is now also a senator who is overseeing the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation. And he himself, on the basis of the evidence that he could see at the outset, believed that it was appropriate to look into potential collusion between the Trump campaign, members of the Trump campaign, or Trump's associates, and Russia. So the idea that it's just critics of Donald Trump who are supporting this doesn't hold up if you look at the details. The other thing I would mention, one other example beyond the ones that Susan cited, is Roger Stone, who's an on and off again advisor to Donald Trump, who initially said he had no contact with Russian representatives at all. But then later it was presented to him that, in fact, he had exchanged private Twitter messages with the online persona known as Guccifer, which 17 U.S. intelligence agencies have decided is a representative of Russian intelligence. In that case, it's going to be up to the investigative agencies and to Senator Burr and his colleagues to determine whether Roger Stone knew or did not know that he was communicating with Russia. And the reason why I think that matters is that we may find out over the course of this process that in Paul Manafort's case or in Roger Stone's case or others, or in Carter Page's case, he's now acknowledged that the FBI has told him that he was in contact with a Russian intelligence agent in the past, that it may turn out that in some cases they may not have even fully understood who it was they were talking to. And then the question becomes, did they know or should they have known? But to say that there's absolutely no evidence at this point understates what Republicans in the Senate have already described.
Before you go, just to finish up on some developments this morning, just coming across now as it just happened, the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, vows in a hearing to tell Congress if the White House tries to meddle in the Russia probe, but says there has been no interference yet. I guess firing Comey doesn't count as interference, according to McCabe, but that was supposed to be Comey at that hearing today. Instead, now it's acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe. But for what it's worth, he did vow to tell Congress if the White House tries to meddle in the Russia probe and that it will not be impeded. And the other thing, and one of you mentioned this briefly in passing before, I see just this morning President Trump issued an executive order creating, is it a commission to study voter fraud and voter suppression So, Susan, on that one, have you been able to read the executive order yet? And do you have a sense that it will be real? Because the evidence seems to indicate that there's a lot more voter suppression than voter fraud from what we know. If that's the case, will they find it?
Well, it is interesting. One notable thing, Vice President Pence is going to head this commission. This is a commission that the White House actually said they was going to establish some time ago after the president continued to insist he'd been the victim of massive voter fraud. I understand the vice chairman is going to be Kris Kobach, who is the Secretary of State of Kansas, my home state, someone who's been very aggressively pushing the idea that there is massive voter fraud. So interesting that the White House chose to put him in a senior position at this commission. But it has been expanded to include also voter suppression. And so we'll see, we'll see how serious a job they do. One thing the White House said this morning was it was going to be not just backward-looking at the 2016 campaign, but forward-looking at what else needs to happen in American voting systems. And that may not be a bad thing. You know, there are some questions about how up-to-date our voting systems are, especially in some states.
I don't know if they're going to count laws that are passed with the intent of suppressing groups of voters as voter suppression, because they've actually been passed and signed by governors. But, Evan, a final word on this?
Well, I actually, if I may, a final word on the subject of what the caller asked about, which
Please.
Is about opinion versus opinion versus reporting. The truth is that every presidential election is accompanied by some level of accusation that reporters are prosecuting a personal agenda rather than reporting the facts. But this one is at a whole new level. And I think what it might be a surprise to discover that, the truth is reporters tend to have one master, one boss, and that is to try to get the best obtainable version of the truth. And so when we are told things that aren't true, it sort of unleashes the animal spirits of the media. It makes us concerned. It makes us worried. And it doesn't matter if the person who's saying it is a Democrat or a Republican or something else. It's when we are told things that are untrue that it generates a lot of energy. And I think that may be the reason why we're dealing with a new era, because there is simply much more untruth being circulated here in Washington than we've seen at other moments. And it takes a lot of work to try to separate it.
Evan Osnos writes about politics for The New Yorker. Susan Page is the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Thank you both so much.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Walter Isaacson next. Stay with us.